ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। नारायणं नमस्कृत्य नरं चैव नरोत्तमं देवीं सरस्वतीं व्यासं ततो जायमुदीरयेत् नष्टप्रायेषु अभद्रेषु नित्यं भागवत सेवया भगवतीरुत्तमश्लोके भक्तिर्भवति नैष्टिकी कृष्णाय वासुदेवाय देवकी नन्दनाय च नन्दगोपकुमाराय गोविन्दाय नमो नमः। ग्रंथराज श्रीमद् भागवतम कैंटो 5 चैप्टर 13 चैप्टर एंटाइटल्ड रघुगुणा कॉन्वर्सेस विद जड भरत वर्स नंबर 6। क्वचिद् वितोया सरितो भियाति परस्परं चलास्ते निरंधा आसाद्यदावं क्वचिदग्नितप्तो निर्विद्यते क्वच यक्षैर्हितासु क्वचिद् वितो यासरितो भियाति परस्परं चालशते निरंधा आसाद्यदावं क्वचिदग्नितप्तो निर्विद्यते क्वच यक्षैर्हितासु क्वचिद् वितो या सरितो भियाति परस्परं चालशते निरंधा आसाद्यदावं क्वचिदग्नितप्तो निर्विद्यते क्वच यक्षैर्हितासु क्वच यक्षैर्हितासु परं चालसते निरंधा तासु नल्स वैष्णवीस क्वचेद समटाइम्स वितो यहा without depth to the water saritah rivers abhiyati he goes to bathe or jumps into parasparam one another asa sorry parcha and alashate desires nirandaha being with no stock of food asadya experiencing davam a forest fire in family life kvachet sometimes agnitaptaha burned by fire.
Nirvidyate
is despondent.
Kvachi, nirvidyate, kva,
somewhere. Cha, and.
Yakshai,
by kings resembling rogues and thieves.
Rita,
taken away.
Asuhu,
wealth, which is as dear as one's life. Translation and purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. Translation. Sometimes the conditioned soul jumps into a shallow river, or being short of food grains, he goes to beg food from people who are not at all charitable. Sometimes he suffers from the burning heat of household life, which is like a forest fire. And sometimes he becomes sad to have his health, which is as dear as life, plundered by kings in the name of heavy income taxes.
Purport.
When one is hot due to the scorching sun, one sometimes jumps into a river to gain relief. However, if the river is almost dried up and the water is too shallow, one may break his bones by jumping in. The conditioned soul is always experiencing miserable conditions. Sometimes his efforts to get help from friends are exactly like jumping into a dry river. By such actions, he does not derive any benefit. He only breaks his bones. Sometimes, suffering from a shortage of food, one may go to a person who is neither able to give charity nor willing to do so. Sometimes one is stationed in household life, which is compared to a forest fire, samsara davana lidhaloka. When a man is heavily taxed by the government, he becomes very sad. Heavy taxation obliges one to hide his income. But despite this endeavor, the government agents are often so vigilant and strong that they take all the money anyway. And the conditioned soul becomes very aggrieved. Thus, people are trying to become happy within the material world, but this is like trying to be happy in a forest fire. No one needs to go to a forest to set it ablaze. Fire takes place automatically. Similarly, no one wants to be unhappy in family life or worldly life. But by the laws of nature, unhappiness and distress are forced upon everyone. To become dependent on another's maintenance is very degrading. Therefore, according to the Vedic system, everyone should live independently. Only the Shudras are unable to live independently. They are obliged to serve someone for maintenance. It is said in the Shastras, Kalau Shudra Sambhava, in the age of Kali, everyone is dependent on another's mercy for the maintenance of the body. Therefore, everyone is classified as a Shudra. In the 12th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, it is said that in Kali Yuga, the government will levy taxes without reciprocally benefiting the citizens. Anavrittisya vinankshayanti durbhiksha karapiditaha. In this age, there will also be a shortage of rain. Therefore, a scarcity of food will arise and the citizens will be very much harassed by government taxation. In this way, the citizens will abandon their attempts to lead a peaceful life and will leave their homes and hearts and go to the forest in sheer disappointment.
Om Ajnanati Mirandasya Jnananjana Shalakaya Chakshurun Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Shri Chaitanya Manobhishtam Sthapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Kadamaiham Dadati Swapadantikam Vandeham Shri Guru Shri Uta Padakamalam Shri Gurun Vaishnavamsha Shri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagana Raghunathan Vitam Tam Sujivam Sadvaitam Savadhutam Parijana Sahitam Krishna Chaitanya Devam Shri Radha Krishna Padan Sahagana Lalita Shri Vishakhan Vitamsha Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prishtaya Bhutale Shrimate Bhakti Vedanta Swami Tinamine Namaste Saraswati Deve Gauravani Pracharane Nirvishesha Shunyavadi Paschatya Deshatarine Namo Mahavadanyaya Krishna Prema Pradayate Krishnaya Krishna Chaitanya Namne Gauratvishe Namaha He Krishna Karuna Sindho Dinabandho Jagatpate Gopesha Gopika Kanta Radha Kanta Namostute తప్త కాంచన గౌరాంగి రాధే వృందావనేశ్వరి ఋషభానుసుతే దేవి ప్రణమామి హరి ప్రియే వాంఛాకల్పతరుభ్యశ్చ కృపాసింధుభ్యేవ చ పతితానాం పావనేభ్యో వైష్ణవేభ్యో నమో నమః జై శ్రీ కృష్ణ చైతన్య ప్రభు నిత్యానంద శ్రీ అద్వైత గదాధార శ్రీవాసాది గౌరభక్తవృంద హరే కృష్ణ 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 హరే 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 రామ 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 హరే 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 కృష్ణ.
సో టుడే మార్నింగ్ వి ఆర్ డిస్కసింగ్ ది పెనల్టిమేట్ చాప్టర్ ఆఫ్ ది పాస్ట్ టైమ్ ఆఫ్ జడ్ భరత్. సో దిస్ స్టార్టెడ్ విత్ ది 7th చాప్టర్ roughly. The 5th chapter is Rishabhdev's instructions, 6th chapter is the departure of Rishabhdev, and then from there onwards Bharat Maharaj pastime starts. So this goes on till the next chapter, where in the next chapter whatever is described metaphorically over here by Rahugana to Rahugana by Jad Bharat, so he, that will be elaborated by Shukadev Goswami to Parikshit Maharaj. So here what is happening is a multiple level conversation. So here we have a conversation between Jada Bharat and Maharaj Rahugana. That is a conversation between Maitreya Rishi and Vidura. That is a conversation between Parikshit Maharaj and Shukadev Goswami. That is a conversation between Shuta Goswami and the Sejasar Naimisharanya. And ultimately, that is a conversation between the Vyasadev and us, the readers. And at the deepest level, this is to be a conversation between the super soul and the soul in the heart. So whatever we hear, the soul and super soul, they are separated by a big wall of false ego. So what the super soul speaks cannot be heard by us directly. That's why the super soul manifests externally through various spiritual masters, so that we can hear. And the more we hear from the external spiritual masters, the more the wall between the soul and the super soul starts breaking down. So the more we hear externally, the more we become capable of hearing internally. The less we hear externally, the less we remain capable of hearing internally. Why? Because that same Krishna has manifested externally. And when Krishna sees that we want to take guidance, instruction and application in our lives, then he gives us not just externally but also internally. But when Krishna sees that we don't take the instructions that we are getting from external sources, then he says, if you don't want it, then I won't interfere in your life. Then Krishna will not give us guidance internally. So ultimately, when we say the scriptures are meant to be lived, life in the shelter, in the light of the scriptures, how do we do that? The scriptures are ultimately meant to connect us with the super soul. When we get connected to the super soul, then we live in the light of the scriptures. So this particular pastime is among the most radically world-negating pastimes in the Srimad Bhagavatam. World-negating means this world is just a place of misery. Reject it. Get out of here. So, this probably, this chapter and the next chapter are the most hard-hitting of all the chapters of the Srimad Bhagavatam as far as condemnation of material existence and material life is concerned. Of course, this is a recurrent theme in the Srimad Bhagavatam. Prahlad Maharaj talks about Hitvatma Patam Grahamanda Koopam, that material life is like a deep dark well. But emphatically, it is most emphasized throughout in this canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam. First in the 5th chapter, where Rishabhdev's teachings are also quite hard-hitting. And again in Jad Bharat's teachings, which are also very hard-hitting. So, what is the end result? Maharaj Rahugana, generally speaking, the Srimad Bhagavatam is basically centered on a tension between karmakanda and bhakti. This whole central, every book has a central tension that is being resolved. For example, in the Bhagavad Gita, the central tension that is being resolved is the conflict between kula dharma and kshatriya dharma. For Arjuna, the Kula Dharma is that he should protect the members of his dynasty. The Kshatriya Dharma is that he should never withdraw from battle. So every book, essentially for it to be able to engage its readers and carry them forward, needs to have a central tension that is developed and resolved as the book progresses. So the central tension in the Srimad Bhagavatam is between Karmakanda and Shuddha Bhakti. And we see that right in the start of the first canto, where the Naimisharanya sages are performing the fire sacrifices. And they say, our eyes have become black because of these fire sacrifices. We have got no tangible realization. Now that you have come, we will hear from you, Sita Goswami. So, they were performing Karmakanda sacrifices, and then they left that for the sake of doing the Shravanam Kirtanam, which is the Bhagavat Vidhi for Bhakti. So similarly, if we see, you can go over this canto by canto, but we will focus on a few sections over here. In the fourth canto, there is the pastime of Prachini Parishad. Now Prachini Parishad is not a godless, sinful materialist. He is a pious, religious materialist. He is a Karmakandi. So he has a sort of intense discussion or intense instruction session he receives from Narad Muni. And then the resolution is, give up Karmakanda, practice Shuddha Bhakti. Here also in the fifth canto, again we will see that Rahugana is not a sinful king. He is a virtuous king. And if we look at the previous sections, his questions are also intelligent. He says actually for a king it is his duty to engage the citizens in their proper prescribed duties. If I don't do that, then I'll be sinful, and how will the citizens be elevated? So he's talking about duty, but from the bodily point of view. Karmakanda doesn't necessarily free us from the bodily point of view. Karmakanda is actually the place where religion and the bodily conception intersect. Now, bodily conception is one circle, religion is another circle. Karmakanda is where religion and bodily conception intersect. Yes, in the bodily conception, I want material enjoyment. And you get material enjoyment, but get it by religious means. Now, we will rarely find Indra acting as if he thinks I am not the body, I am the soul. He knows that in the background, but actually he is interested in the world, heavenly enjoyment. He is interested in the apsaras, he is interested in the wealth. So, the Vedic scriptures ultimately tell us to give up the bodily conception, but not immediately. There is a gradual progression over there. So when Shukadeva Goswami is going to narrate to Parikshit Maharaj, at that time Parikshit Maharaj is not led gradually to give up the bodily conception, because he has only 7 days, and that time it is a state of emergency. That's why the narratives that Srimad Bhagavatam focuses on are not Karmakanda narratives, which will gradually free a person from the bodily conception. The Bhagavatam's narratives are primarily pure devotional service, which rejects the bodily conception completely. So this same tension we will see in the sixth canto, in the conflict between Daksha Prajapati and Narad Muni again. Daksha Prajapati is a religious person, and he is so religious that he actually sends his sons to do austerities, although he wants them to come back and become Prajapatis, become producers of the future generations of humanity, but still with austerity, not animalistic sense gratification. But Narada Muni tells him, don't get into all this, just renounce the world. So this is the central conflict in the Srimad Bhagavatam. I just gave examples from 3 cantos, 4th, 5th, 6th, and of course the first canto, to illustrate this point. So we need to understand that actually when the Vedic scriptures talk this world is dukkhalayam, it is certainly a factual reality. At the same time, how is that knowledge translated into our living is very important to understand. So in today's class, I will not focus so much directly on the point that this world is dukkhalayam. We have heard many classes on this topic, and what Srila Prabhupada says in this purport is becoming increasingly evident, that the government taxes people more and more. In fact, in several countries like America and European Union, normally, logically, it should be that the wealthier should be taxed more and the poorer should be taxed less. But in several countries, actually, the wealthier a person is, the lesser the taxation on that person. Because that is their logic is that, then the wealthy people have a lot of money, and if they have a lot of money, if they are not taxed so much, then there will be more free money available in the economy. It's a crazy idea. But the point is, poor people get taxed a lot. So what Srila Prabhupada says is becoming increasingly true. And for many businessmen, the worst nightmare of their lives is an income tax raid. An income tax raid. One of my friends is a officer in income tax office. He says that the business people fear us as much as they fear terrorists. Of course, even in the income tax department, there is a huge amount of corruption. And then there, so ultimately they try to evade taxes, as Prabhupada says here in this purport, that they try to evade taxes in various ways, but the government agents are also very expert. So then they get caught and they get disappointed. So Prabhupada talks about how this is one kind of misery in this world. So I will not focus on the principle that this world is a place of misery. I will focus on how this knowledge of the miserable nature of material existence translates into a practical way of living. One of the central accusations against Vedic philosophy that is leveled by many Western thinkers and by Western culture in general is that it is extremely pessimistic. You say this world is a place of misery. It's so pessimistic. So, and especially in the hippie generation, when Srila Prabhupada went to the West, the post Second World War generation of America, they became very interested in India. Traditionally for America, there was only one holy place, that was in Israel. Jerusalem, Nazareth, Bethlehem, all those places. Radharas Bihari Bhagwan ki jai. But from the 1950s onwards, because of the persistence inflow of many spiritual teachers from India to the West, India became seen as an alternative holy place, a spiritual place where one's inner longings can be fulfilled. So many people came to India in search of God at that time, and they had read some, they had heard something from some spiritual teachers, they had read some spiritual books, the Upanishads. They had been fascinated. This fascination with India started right from the 17th century onwards. And Schopenhauer and all those philosophers, they wrote widely about India. In fact, Voltaire, who strongly rejected Christianity, was one of the strongest critics of Christianity. He said, everything good in the world has come from the banks of the Ganges. Everything good in the world has come from the banks of the Ganges. So there was a great fascination with India based on the thought systems that India had produced. Of course, most of these people had monistic ideas, because that was the school of thought that was exported from India initially, before Srila Prabhupada went abroad. But anyway, there was a lot of fascination. However, when many of these Western thinkers came to India, that fascination transformed into vexation and frustration. Because they just couldn't link the two together. There were such exalted thought systems were produced by India, but the living conditions of India were so abominable, were so terrible, that it seemed that even basic human concern was not there. Just beggars lying on thousands in the streets, poor and wounded with wounds uncovered and infected and infested with germs and flies, and nobody caring for them. So the sights of the heartbreaking poverty of India just made these people think, how is it possible that the same civilization that can produce such lofty levels of thought can also tolerate such filthy levels of living among its own brethren? These Indians, didn't they feel any sympathy, any compassion, any practical desire to help their fellow human beings? So this, in fact, many of the people who came seeking for India, they got turned off because of this. They thought all this thought system that are there are all impractical. and they went back abroad. Some of them became CEOs of big companies, and some of them went back and they became Buddhists. So the point here is that at the end of the day, most people don't just want to understand what your thought systems are. People also want to see what your practical prescription for the world is. What can you offer to the world practically? And we do say that this world is a place of misery. But it is not that we create misery in this world, or we let misery continue to exist in this world. I just give a simple example for this, to illustrate this, that we know when Shukadev Goswami, for the last 7 days of Parikshit Maharaj's life, was continuously speaking Srimad Bhagavatam. At that time, Parikshit Maharaj and all these sages assembled over there sat there without eating, without drinking, without sleeping. And we glorify them for their one pointed attention and hearing. But is that something that can be a standard recommendation for humanity at all times? We see within the Srimad Bhagavatam itself, in the fourth canto, when the citizens come to Prithu Maharaj and tell him, we are all starving because there is no grains and no food on the earth. Like they use a very poetic metaphor. They say, just as a forest is burned by leaves, he says, we are being burned from within by the digestive fire. So what does Prithu Maharaj say over there? Does he say, just neglect your body, absorb yourself in hearing and chanting? Does he say that? He doesn't. But he takes assertive action. He is even ready to attack and kill the earth even when she has taken the form of a cow. Normally a cow should never be killed. But Maharaj Prithu considers that this earth has derelicted her duty. Earth is meant to produce food grains for the subsistence of all citizens. And when she is not producing the food grains, she has given up her duty and therefore she deserves to be punished. So, he doesn't tell his citizens, oh, now all of you have got realization, this world is a place of misery, now just get rid of the world. What to speak of Prithu Maharaj, even Parikshit Maharaj himself. No, when Kali comes and is trying to kill the cow and attack the bull, at that time he doesn't say, oh yeah, now this world is Dukkhalayam, now everybody can see this world is Dukkhalayam. So he doesn't say that. Again, he takes assertive action. And importantly, in both cases of Prithu Maharaj and Parikshit Maharaj, the Bhagavatam glorifies them for what they do. The Bhagavatam glorifies Prithu Maharaj for his diligence in royal administration, and the Bhagavatam glorifies Prithu Maharaj. Why is that? If ultimately this world is to be transcended and we understand this world is a place of misery, then why is the arrangement of the necessities of life in this world glorified? We need to understand that the Vedic culture recognizes that this world is temporary, it is a place of misery. But this world also has to serve as a foundation by which we can take off for the journey to the spiritual world. And for that purpose to be served, for this world to serve as a foundational takeoff for going to the spiritual world, there has to be order in this world. The same Lord Krishna who declares twice in the Bhagavad Gita that this world is a place of misery, he describes first in 8.15, Dukkhalayam Ashashvatam, and he again describes in 9.33, Anityam Asukham Lokam Imam Prapya Bhajaswamam. So twice he declares, but that same Lord Krishna also says in 4.7 and 8 that Yada yada hi dharmasya glanir bhavati bharata abhyuttanam dharmasya tadatmanam sujamyaham. He says, I descend in this world and what do? I restore order in this world. So, when Krishna says this world is a place of misery, he doesn't condemn and reject this world. He is concerned that order be there in this world. So essentially, there are two ethos. Ethos means underlying fabric of thought. There is the Brahminical ethos and there is the Kshatriya ethos. What is the Brahminical ethos? The Brahminical ethos is, if somebody insults you, somebody attacks you, somebody torments you, then just tolerate it. Just tolerate it. And we see this exemplified in Vishwamitra, who was earlier a king, coming and trying to steal the cow of Vasishtha. So at that time, what does Vasishtha do? He doesn't do anything. He says, the king is coming and taking, and let him take. And then at that time the cow says, are you displeased with me? He says, no, I am very pleased with you. But as a Brahmana, I am not supposed to raise weapons. And therefore, I can't do anything. He says, no, you don't have to raise weapons. You just instruct me and I will produce Kshatriyas. And he says, yes, do it. So Vasishtha follows his duty as a Brahmana, but he recognizes that what Vishwamitra is doing over there, what Kaushika is doing over there, is irreligious. And if somebody else is ready to raise weapons for that, he gives consent for that. What is the consent that he gives? Consent, he says, produce weapons and fight. So actually it's a similar situation to a cow being attacked, and Parikshit Maharaj is being observed, is observing Kali doing that. And Vishwamitra is doing, Kaushika is doing that to Vasishtha's cow. So the Brahminical ethos is just tolerate and transcend. Just tolerate whatever happens in this world. The Kshatriya ethos is take action. And Krishna, when he comes in this world, he comes primarily as a Kshatriya. And his assertion is take action. So if we see, there is, when Jesus Christ came and preached, what he preached was some kind of Brahminical ethos. The idea that if somebody slaps you on one side, turn the other cheek. If somebody plucks out one eye, offer the other eye. However, Christianity did not spread much through Jesus' teachings. In the Christian tradition, one of the apostles is St. Paul. And St. Paul acted as a Kshatriya. And he consolidated the Christian kingdom. And it was under him that actually Christianity was a small subsect within Judaism. Jesus never rejected Judaism directly. He wanted to reform Judaism. But the Jews, through the conspiracy of the Romans, crucified him. And then Paul basically came up with many ideas that were radically contradicting Christianity. The point I am making over here is, just a Brahminical culture cannot transform society. So, it was only when Paul came up and assertively started spreading Christianity in an organized way. He wrote letters, he gave instructions, he traveled around, his epistles are a very important part of the Bible. Some people say actually Paul distorted Jesus' teaching. Some people say that he expanded Jesus' teaching. Whatever it is. The point is, any school of thought can influence society only when the Brahminical and the Kshatriya systems come together. If we look at the history of Islam, we will see this tension evident even in the Quran. When Muhammad was in Mecca, most of the teachings that he gave are Brahminical. He says there should be no force in religion. He says those who criticize you, neglect them. But as the people started becoming more and more oppressive against him, his teachings became more and more Kshatriya-like. And then he had to flee from Mecca to Medina. So the Bible was revealed, the Quran was revealed primarily at two places. The Mecca, where Muhammad was primarily staying, and Medina, where he eventually later stayed. So at Medina, most of his teachings are very hardline. So there is that infamous 9.5, the verse of the sword. Kill the kafirs wherever you see them. So don't ask any questions, don't talk anything, just kill them wherever you see them. So overall, in the Islamic tradition, the Kshatriya ethos totally dominated and subsumed the Brahminical ethos. And that's why today Islam has become more of a political search for power in the guise of religion and less a spiritual search for truth in the form of religion. So There are still many sincere Muslims who are trying to approach God, but predominantly the Kshatriya ethos has predominated Islam, and then now it has become perverted in the form of terrorism, where Kshatriyas are originally meant to protect the innocent. Now the terrorists, they use weapons, but they are targeting the innocent and the weaponless. But the point which we are making over here is that actually if we study the essential teachings of Christianity, Islam or the Vedic literature, there is this basic point. They also outline to some extent that this world is temporary, this world is a place of misery, the pleasures of this world are seductions which will trap us and entangle us, and our real abode is in the other world. That is our shelter, that is our goal. Srila Prabhupada was asked, how do we know whether a religion is bona fide? He gave basically two characteristics. Do they accept devotion to a personal God? And do they accept that there is an eternal kingdom where is our original home? So, essentially, this is a tension that every religious tradition has to resolve. So in India, if we look at the history of India before there was aggression on India, starting from in 1000 was the first attack on India by Islamic invaders. If we look before that, India was tremendously prosperous. And India was also religious at that time. So the Kshatriyas who were ruling the world, they knew that this world is a place of misery. But that did not stop them from making proper arrangements in this world for the practice of dharma here. Just like I was talking about how, you know, the idea that don't bother about food, just absorb yourself in hearing. That is good in principle, but in practice that is not a lifelong recommendation. You know, most of us, if we didn't know that after a Bhagavatam class there is prasad waiting for us, how much would we be able to concentrate on hearing? And if it would be a daily uncertainty, it wouldn't work. That's why Srila Prabhupada, he told us that in ISKCON, we want Brahmanas with a Kshatriya spirit. We want Brahmanas with a Kshatriya spirit. We have to have a Brahmanical intellectual understanding. But at the same time, we have to have the Kshatriya proactivity, the Kshatriya vision to actually arrange and manage and coordinate things in this world. If both are not there, if there is only a Brahmanical ethos, then nothing much happens in the world. You cannot change the world much. So the example of this is Buddhism. You know, the Buddhists have the idea of non-violence, so we will not use any weapons against anyone. So then what has happened? China attacked Tibet, and they have lost Tibet. They can't do anything about it. And in despair, they say that we should not raise weapons against anyone else, but the Buddhist monks are actually doing violence against themselves. They are doing self-immolation. Buddhist monks, in frustration because of the Chinese rule, they burn themselves up. So that's also a form of violence. No killing also includes no killing yourself, isn't it? So actually speaking, a purely Brahmanical ethos is not going to practically bring any transformation in the world. And a purely Kshatriya ethos is going to transform the world, but in a disastrous way. In a disastrous way. Why? Because if there is no spiritual philosophical understanding of the next world, then power will corrupt people, and corrupt people terribly. So I talked about how Islam has become politicized, but even worse, where the Kshatriya ethos divorced completely of a Brahmanical ethos, the example of that is Soviet Union and China. Actually, the number of people who died in the Second World War, 7 times more people were killed in the rule of communism in Stalin's China and Mao Zedong's Stalin's Russia, Stalin's USSR and Mao Zedong's China. And these were their own countrymen who were killed. So why? Because they felt, my way is the only way, anyone who opposes my way, just kill them. So we need a proper balance of a Brahmanical ethos and a Kshatriya ethos. When the two come together, then there will be a transformation that is positive and beneficial for society. So to understand this, I'll give one simple metaphor. So we understand this world is a place of misery. So this understanding metaphorically can be extended. So this world is like a hospital.
Now, if some patient wants just, okay, I want to build my house in the hospital and I want to have a television and I want to have a movie theater and I want to enjoy in the hospital, that's stupid. But at the same time, if the hospital is to serve its purpose, the hospital has to be organized and managed properly. Only then will the hospital serve its purpose of curing the patients. The doctors, the machines, the medicines, all of them have to be very carefully managed. Similarly, this world, although it's a place of misery, so the materialists, they think, okay, we'll become happy over here itself. We'll become happy over here itself. But that is not possible, because this world makes us miserable, not just because of janma mrityu jara vyadhi, but also because of adhibhautik, adhidaivik, adhyatmik klesh. I wrote an article on karma there in my book Science and Spirituality, where I correlated how over the last 50 years, now I compared the number of, we cannot really quantify the law of karma, but still we can get a general indication of this. So basically, the karmic reactions come to us as adhyatmik, adhibhautik and adhidaivik kleshas. So I, in a general way, tried to quantify what was the nature of adhyatmik, adhibhautik and adhidaivik klesha at the start of the 19th century and what was the nature of that at the start of the 20th century. Or rather, at the start of the 20th century and at the start of the 21st century, in the last 100 years. So in the last 100 years, we know that abortion was legalized, that illicit sex increased tremendously, slaughterhouses have expanded horrifyingly. So Prabhupada said these two are the primary sources of bad karma, abortion and animal slaughter. So if we look at the amount of adhyatmik klesh, the kind of diseases that were there, especially they say, the kind of mental problems that were there at the start of the last century and the start of this century. Huge, much, much more in this century than in the previous century. If we look at adhidaivik klesh, the natural calamities that are there. Now, I wrote this article and the tsunami had come. So just from 2000 to 2004, the number of natural disasters and the damages caused by the natural disasters was more than any single full decade from 1950 to 2000. So many more disasters are coming. So that's adhidaivik klesh. And adhibhautik klesh, we see there are divorces, there are relationship conflicts, there is violence. It's far, far more now. In fact, in the last one century, the number of deaths due to violence and murder is more than the number of deaths in the previous 19 centuries combined together. And it's not just more, it is 7 times more than the number of deaths in the previous 19 centuries combined together. So, what it means is, we can see in a general way, not in a specific one-to-one correlational way, but in a general way, that as people do bad karma, the reactions increase in terms of adhyatmik, adhibhautik and adhidaivik kleshas. So now, why are people doing bad karma? Now, it's not that people want to be sinful. Actually, people just want to enjoy life. And in the hope of enjoying life, they often cross moral boundaries and commit sinful activities. And why do people want to enjoy in an unregulated way? Because they think this is the way to live life. They think this is the place of enjoyment, and they don't believe or know about some other world that is the place of enjoyment. So therefore, the point which I am making to our context is, if somebody tries to convert a hospital into an enjoyable place, he makes things worse over there. The hospital is not meant to be a 5-star hotel for enjoyment, isn't it? So somebody tries to, so the whole modern materialistic way of living is to try to convert a hospital into a 5-star hotel. But if somebody says, okay, the hospital is a place of misery, why bother to take care of anything? Then what will happen? And the hospital will not serve its purpose. So we see in India, as the Kshatriya rule fell because of, say, 800 years of Islamic attacks and then 200 years of British rule, then because the Brahminical culture lost the support of the Kshatriya infrastructure. So infrastructure is that which is used to implement whatever is the vision. So there is the Brahminical vision, the Brahminical philosophical understanding has to be coupled with Kshatriya infrastructure. That's why when the Europeans and Americans came to India, they say, oh, you people have produced such great thoughts, but look at your life. So look at the poverty that is there in society. This poverty is not a product of Vedic culture. It is a product of the weakening and the destruction of Vedic culture. As far as the infrastructure for managing the world is concerned. So how does all this apply to us as practicing devotees? First of all, from a philosophical point of view, we need to be clear that I shouldn't try to enjoy life in this world. I shouldn't try to enjoy life in this world because that will simply lead to misery. But at the same time, that doesn't mean that because this world is a misery, I just don't care about anything in this world. No, although this world is a place of misery, this world is also the essential gateway by which people can go back to the spiritual world. And it is my responsibility to make sure that this gateway, this takeoff launching pad, functions effectively. So therefore, as devotees who are part of the Krishna conscious movement, whatever resources Krishna has given us, we can't say that if the food is not cooked properly in prasadam, if the arrangements for the programs are not made properly, you preacher, you are going to preach this world dukkhalayam, the mic system is not working. See, now you are realizing it is dukkhalayam. No, we can't do like that. We have to make arrangements properly. Why? The world is going to produce misery anyway. We don't have to increase its misery. Rather, we have to arrange things in a way that people can find a way out of the misery. And when will people see this as a way out of misery? When they see sanctuaries that are shelters, the centers of serenity and happiness. So the temples have to be places where people are happy. And if materially everything is disorganized, people cannot be happy. We can't say people will be materially happy. But materially things have to be basically organized. Bhavanand Prabhu said that when he was there in Mayapur, Prabhupada was so conscientious about everything material. He said if there would be one tap which would leak one drop of water every 6 hours. And he said Prabhupada would come in front of the tap when that one drop would be falling and he would say, you are wasting Krishna's energy. So Prabhupada did not say, oh, this is dukkhalayam, let the water flow on. So, the idea of this world is dukkhalayam is not a license for rejecting this world or acting irresponsibly in this world. This world is dukkhalayam, but we have to act responsibly so that we can become purified, we can become disentangled from this world, and we can enable others to become purified and disentangled. And we see Srila Prabhupada himself was very competent and responsible about everything that he did. He wanted the management to be pakka. Of course, Srila Prabhupada, when he personally had to choose between a Brahminical ethos and a Kshatriya ethos, he, after the initial days from 1968-69 onwards, he practically withdrew from the management. And he focused on preaching and writing. But still he was available for his managers whenever he needed, whenever it was needed. And he did give directions through letters to his managers. But the point was, Srila Prabhupada did want things to work out in a appealing way, even materially within the moment. So not that our goal is to make material arrangements, is not that we will become happy in the material world. But our goal is that the material arrangements will have a basic peaceful substratum by which people can practice spiritual life. So therefore, even when we hear these sort of descriptions that this world is a place of misery, so that doesn't mean that we just reject. Say if a person is a householder, the whole householder order is a place of misery. What should I do therefore? Does that mean I reject everything? No, that's not the idea. The idea is that we don't have to reject the material world. We have to reject the idea that the material world can make us happy. Having rejected that idea, we also have to recognize the utility of this world. The utility of the world is that this world can act as a launching pad for helping us return back to the spiritual world. So, I'll conclude with three quick words to summarize. The materialists glamorize this world. The impersonalists, the Mayavadis, they demonize this world. Glamorize means, this world, so much happiness is there. Just come to Bollywood, come to Hollywood. There's so much happiness in this world. They glamorize the world. the impersonalists, the Mayavadis, they demonize the world. Everything here is filled with misery. Everything here is a trap. And don't get entangled in this world. The Bhaktas neither glamorize the world nor demonize the world. They utilize the world. So we don't glamorize, we don't demonize, we utilize the world. But for us to utilize the world, we have to be responsible. And when we utilize the world effectively, then within the devotee community, we can have order at the material level and potency at the spiritual level. We need these two things. Within the devotee community, we need order at the material level. Things have to be orderly. You know, prasadam has to be there on time. The programs have to be managed properly. Follow-up has to be done properly. If we have big festivals, Rath Yatras and other festivals, there has to be order at the material level. And, but you know, there are many, for example, there may be sports events where everything is ordered very nicely. But then, there is no potency at the spiritual level over there. So, the potency at the spiritual level will come by the hearing and chanting. So, in our movement, the morning program that we have, that creates potency at the spiritual level. And the remaining day we do practical services, that creates order at the material level. So, if we emphasize one over the other, if we go too much in the direction of sadhana, because I want potency, fine, we will have potency, but nobody will be benefited by that. So, on the other hand, if we go too much in the direction of management and doing practical things in the world, we'll do things in the world, but we'll ourselves forget the purpose for which we are doing it. So, when we have the proper philosophical understanding, and then we blend the Brahminical ethos and the Kshatriya ethos, then we will have potency at the spiritual level, order at the material level. And then, we can come out of this Dukkhalayam Shashvatam and return back to the spiritual world, which is Sukhalayam Shashvatam. So I'll summarize what I discussed. I went over a broad scope of issues. So I focused on the main theme of how does the idea that this world is Dukkhalayam translate into action in this world. So I started by discussing about how Western thinkers, Western seekers, when they came to India, they were disappointed. You people have such lofty thoughts, but your living is so filthy. Why is that? Because the Brahmanical and Kshatriya ethos had got ruptured in India. The products of the Brahmanical thought had remained, but the Kshatriya order had collapsed. Then I discussed the various... So I discussed from the Bhagavatam itself, this it's essential Bhagavatam, because it is at the moment of death. It is spoken to a person at the moment of death. So it rejects all Kshatriya ethos, practically speaking. Just focus on the Brahmanical ethos. Glorify somebody who just 7 days can hear and chant without bothering about arranging food. That is a prescription for that particular purpose, person, Parikshit Maharaj. But then we saw the Kshatriya ethos in Parikshit Maharaj attacking Kali and Dhrupada Maharaj punishing Mother Earth. So, in a broad way, again the Brahmanical ethos and the Kshatriya ethos, the conflict is in Karmakanda and Shuddha Bhakti. I discussed that in 4th, 5th canto, how that conflict is there. Then I discussed the various world religions, how Christianity didn't benefit the world much through Jesus' teaching, but it was when Paul came as a Kshatriya that it benefited the world. In Islam, it had a Kshatriya ethos excessively, because of which it has become a more of a political search for power in the garb of religion. We discussed about Buddhism, which has no Kshatriya ethos, practically speaking. We said no violence, but then they are doing violence against themselves by self-immolation. So the Vedic culture offers us a balance of the two. And what is that balance? This world has to function as a hospital. So the materialists want to glamorize the world and think that this world is a place of happiness. It's like saying the hospital will be an enjoyable place, which is wrong. And I discussed how the more we seek enjoyment in the world, the more there are adhibhautik, adhidaivik, adhyatmik kleshas. But on the other hand, if the hospital is to treat and cure people, it has to be organized properly. So we don't glamorize or demonize the world, we utilize the world. And utilizing means we have to responsibly function in the world so that there is order at the material level and there is potency at the spiritual level. Thank you very much. Are there any questions? Yes, Prabhu.
Yes, Prabhu. Hare Krishna, Prabhuji. Your today's class is very powerful, very empowered and highly enlightening. Your thinking level is very high, very deep. Thank you very much for enlightening us. My question is that in Satyuga, only the meditation was practiced. And the result of meditation is only to realize Paramatma and not Bhagwan. So is it so that in Satyuga people could not access to Bhagwan and had to be satisfied with Paramatma realization only?
Okay, is it true that in Satyuga, because the process was meditation, so people could access only Paramatma but not Bhagwan? It is not necessary that meditation can lead only to Paramatma. It depends on what is the process that meditation is a part of. If we see the smaranam that is there as a limb of bhakti, when that smaranam becomes intensified, Bhaktivinoda Thakur explains that this smaranam is analogous to dhyana, is analogous to dhyana of the yogis. And Srila Prabhupada also explains in a CC purport that even the yogis, when they are doing dhyana, at that time when they realize the Paramatma, depending on their conception and motivation, they have two alternatives. Either they think I am the Paramatma, then they will merge in Paramatma and attain Brahman. They think I am the servant of Paramatma, then they will attain Bhagavan and go back to the spiritual world, usually in a, some kind of shantarasa as trees or something like that. But in general, in the, for example, in the Prema Pradeep, which is a novel written by Bhaktivinoda Thakur, he describes many yogis who are Vaishnavas. So they use yoga as a sadhana. They practice yogasanas as a sadhana for their to assist in their bhakti. So when it is said in Satyuga, Kriteya Dhyayato Vishnu, see, the very verse is not referring to the Paramatma conception. It is referring to a personal conception of God in Vaikuntha. It is not saying Kruteya Dhyayato Paramatma. It is Kruteya Dhyayato Vishnu. So that Yuga Dharma is bhakti. But that bhakti is using yoga sadhana to attain the Supreme Lord. So that's why what will be attained by that, if a person is practicing bhakti, is not Paramatma, it will be Bhagavan. Does that answer your question? Yes, true. Any other questions? Yes, true.
Hare Krishna. This utility is said, Vedic culture is saying that not demoralizing, but we have to utilize. So this Muslim, I have seen few Muslim, they are following the Muslim Quran and all. Even simultaneously they are killing cows and all. But they are very sincere. They, when we approach them, they are welcoming us and they are also sharing our thought. So what kind of, they are demoralizing our these things, Vedic culture, or they are utilizing, getting this? They are demoralizing our Vedic culture, or they are utilizing, because some they are eating cows also, but sometimes they are having good relation with us and they are appreciating our philosophy.
Yes. So in general, some Muslims, you are saying some Muslims may practice sincerely, they may be receptive to us also, but at the same time, they are also involved in killing cows. So in general, if we look at Srila Prabhupada's statements about Islam, overall they are quite positive. Although Srila Prabhupada does talk in the CC purports about how there are many Muslim kings who destroyed the temples in Vrindavan and all that, but if we look at his overall tenor, it's quite positive. So Srila Prabhupada said that all the Muslims, basically Prabhupada appreciates the cultural aspects of sincere following of the religious principles. For example, he says the Muslims learn the verses of the Quran, like that Hindu should learn the Bhagavad Gita verses. The Muslims, whenever they get some money, they build a mosque. So like that Hindus, they have so much money, they should build temples. And so in general, he appreciates the cultural aspects. And Srila Prabhupada is certainly aware that there are these elements of within Islam which are violently against Vedic culture. But in general, like Chanakya Pandit says, see the good in everything. So we see over there that they are following some elements of devotional culture. So we can appreciate that. And there are a small number of Muslims, especially many of the Sufis, they are also vegetarians. So certainly that is a major flaw, killing of cows. And if one actually studies the Quran carefully, there are at least very clear recommendations that one should prefer a vegetarian diet where it is possible. But that has been obfuscated presently. So that is a, like Srila Prabhupada would even criticize Christians, that thou shall not kill, you are neglecting that. Now actually thou shall not kill is not a statement from the Bible. It is a commandment given by Moses. So the Bible generally is said to be the holy book of the Christians. The holy book of the Jews is the Torah. And the holy book of the Jews applies even to the Muslims. Because they also accept Moses as a prophet. They also, Muslims accept Moses and Jesus as a prophet. But they say Muhammad is the last prophet. And he is the best of all prophets. That's their idea. So thou shall not kill applies even to the Muslims actually. It's not just to Christians. Because it's a part of the Ten Commandments. That's a universal dictum for all the religions that come from the Abrahamic tradition. So anyway, we focus on seeing whatever is good in others and encouraging that. Encouraging that. Answer the question? Yeah. Any other questions? So thank you very much. Grantharaj Srimad Bhagavatam ki, Srila Prabhupada ki, Gaura Bhakta Vrinda ki, Itai Gaura Premanande. Thank you very much.